This is one of those stories I feel confident I've told before, but over the years I've learned that you're not actually listening a lot of the time.
No.
So it's okay. Like maybe a quarter of you might remember the story if I have told it. So if you're one of those folks, I apologize. But if not, here's a brand new story for you. So I was in Old Testament class, and in that class, we had this one guy who would ask these questions, and just when his hand went up, when the moment his hand went up, the rest of us would just sink, because we just knew. It was like you can't even anticipate what the question was going to be like, but the all-time great, and I'm going to call him Chris, which is not his name, so that should he ever come, you won't know when I call him by his actual name. But I've never seen him again since Old Testament. But in case I ever run into him. So on this particular day, we were looking at a model of the city of Jerusalem. It's in Jerusalem. They take you there to show you what the city would have looked at around the time of Christ, actually. But our professor had been using the pictures of it to give us a sense of what the old city looked like, so that we could picture in our minds where these stories happened. And it's a wonderful scale replica of the city of Jerusalem from that time. In the slides that Dr. Suter would show us, you could see not just the city, but you could see people walking around the perimeter of it, looking at it, okay? So people who, like when I was there and saw it, were walking around, you could see the city model and the people. So on this particular day, Chris kept raising his hand, and Dr. Suter had reached the point of many of us and was steadfastly ignoring his hand until he could no longer ignore it. So having made whatever points he was going to make, he finally said, "Chris." And Chris said, "Dr. Suter," he talked like that, "Dr. Suter, is that model life size?" And you can see Dr. Suter, just his face like changes colors, like a mood ring at this. And he's trying to bring himself together to answer the question, and finally he just pulled himself together and said, "Chris, do you see the people?" Right? Because if it was life size, these, right? So that moment was like, when I hear this phrase, "There are no stupid questions," I find myself wondering, is that true? You know, because that is like exhibit A of that. So forever, I have heard that. I feel like I've never not known that there are no stupid questions. And yet, I feel like I have both heard stupid questions, and if I am honest, I must say, I have asked my share of what turned out to be stupid questions. And some of them, I knew they were stupid when I asked them, and yet I forged ahead and asked them. So I've heard and asked those kinds of questions. But I will say this. It often is a brave soul who will ignore that voice in your head that's saying, "Don't ask that. Just don't ask that." But will ignore that and go ahead and ask the question. Because the vast majority of the time, the question that they're asking is one that is in somebody else's, at least one somebody else, and perhaps many somebody else's mind as well. And all their voices are saying, "Don't ask too." So very often, the one person who asks actually is asking for many folks, and doing it at the risk of sounding dumb and asking a stupid question. Now, when you think of it, when you actually think of what is a question, why do we ask a question, what's the point of a question really often turns out to be a confession of ignorance, right? I mean, if you knew, you wouldn't ask, because you would know. But if you don't know, your primary way, your easiest way of actually then knowing is to ask someone, or to ask Google and see if Google knows, or ask Wikipedia, but to ask someone. Questions are important in the classroom. I mean, it turns out, I think, that one of the key ways of learning is for people to ask questions, to say, here's what I don't know. Here's what I need you to help me to know, because this is the area where I'm not getting it. Questions are important in relationships. Questions are important in relationships and all kinds of them, however you want to connect that together. In families, between significant others, spouses or boyfriends, girlfriends, questions are important. Between parents and children, questions keep us up to date with where we are with things. They allow us to know things we might not know otherwise. And questions are important in our relationship with God. Questions are vitally important in our relationship with God. And it turns out, I believe, that it is true that especially in that last category, in the questions we ask in our relationship with God, there are no stupid questions. I believe that. My first thought, though, as I was reading through the passage for this week and kind of living with the passage from the ninth chapter of Luke's gospel, that particular part of it, though, this week, was not so much about stupid questions as about wrong questions. I almost thought that the sermon title this morning, for a while, the sermon title actually was The Wrong Question. But the more I thought about it, the more I thought, you know, that's really still not right. It is not the wrong question. Well, what's going on in this passage this morning is the honest question. It is an honest question. And to build on that, I believe God honors honesty. God values honesty from us. So that when we actually talk to God about the real stuff that's actually going on in our lives, God enjoys that from us because God knows the stuff that's actually going on in our lives. If we dress it up as something else, we're just confusing the issue for us because God knows. So I believe God's all about honesty and us asking about what's actually going on in our minds. So, with all that in mind, let's see what's going on in Luke's gospel, particularly in the ninth chapter of Luke's gospel. If you've been reading along, and if you've not, I will fill you in a little bit, but Luke has been building pretty much to this point. So Luke begins with the birth narrative and with Jesus, just a tiny window into his boyhood. But then from about the third chapter till the ninth chapter, it is much about Jesus' activity in his public ministry. Jesus' work around the Sea of Galilee, largely, preaching, teaching, healing. So as we enter into Luke 9, Luke 9 is a long chapter and a lot happens in it. Among those things, though, at the end of it comes a turning point. A turning point in Luke's gospel, I think, I would argue, one of the most important turning points in all of Scripture happens in the ninth chapter of Luke's gospel, in the 51st verse. And in that 51st verse, some translations, I prefer, actually the translation I read this morning doesn't use this language, but I prefer this language, and it says, Jesus sets his face toward Jerusalem. It says, Jesus set his face towards Jerusalem. Here it says something about Jesus deciding to go to Jerusalem. But the Jesus setting his face towards Jerusalem, this is different. Jesus has been to Jerusalem before. He's gone to Jerusalem. He's not deciding again to do what he's already done. When Luke tells us that Jesus sets his face toward Jerusalem, he means Jesus is resolute. Jesus has committed himself. He knows he's going to Jerusalem, and this time will be different than every other trip to Jerusalem. He knows as he goes, and keep in mind, Luke's a fairly lengthy gospel. We're only in chapter 9. So you're embarking at this point on a second phase, which is called Luke's traveling gospel, where he's on his way to Jerusalem. But this decision by Jesus is remarkably important. So Luke 9 leads up to the moment where Jesus makes that announcement to his friends, to his disciples, that off we're going to go to Jerusalem. Prior to that, then, What you have all through Luke 9 is a growing feeling of weight, of importance, of expectation for what's about to happen. You can sense that things are growing more serious, more somber, that we're building towards this moment. So as it opens, we have Jesus feeding 5,000 people. Actually, no, before that, the very beginning of Luke 9, Jesus sends the 12 out by themselves. So he sends his 12 followers out, and it's kind of a trial run for them. Go see what it's like to do this stuff that I've been training you for. So off they go, and individual or together, in twos, but they go out together, and they go do the mission for a while, then they come and report back to Jesus. So that's the beginning. So you see, Jesus is kind of checking, how are they going to be? Because he's preparing to leave them. And so he's got to see where they are on their preparation. They don't understand that exactly at that point, but I think that's what Jesus is about. Then the next story is where he feeds 5,000 people. And if you take it in context of what we've just talked about, there's this great moment where the disciples are saying, we got this problem, there's all these people, we can't feed them, they need to go home. And Jesus says, you give them something to eat. If you only read that story, if you only just read that one story, it's interesting within the context of that story. If you read the whole chapter, if you've read everything to that point, you can see that there's something larger going on than Jesus saying, you do something about this. He's saying, in a way, there will come a time where you will be the ones who must do something about this. So just as he sent them off to go and practice ministry, now they're back with him. He's saying, well, you do something about it. You've identified the problem. Now you work with it. Jesus follows that by being, he's with his followers, and he asks them, who do people say that I am? And they give a variety of answers back, and he says, well, who do you say that I am? And Peter comes up with the answer that you are the Christ, meaning you are the Messiah, sent from God. We're at a good point there. That's a good moment. Question asked by Jesus and the right answer given by Peter. But then Jesus follows it up with really somber news for them about how he will have to die and he will have to suffer. And he says, you must take up your cross and follow me. You can feel the passage getting heavier and heavier as you move along in Luke 9, that they're being asked to assume more and more responsibility, to really understand what they're getting into. You must take up your cross and follow me. Still in Luke 9, you have the story of the transfiguration. So Jesus is on the mountain, and Jesus begins to glow, and there's this wonderful announcement of, this is my beloved son, a reminder from God of who Jesus is for those handful of disciples who are with him. And then Jesus leaves the mountain and goes down the mountain, back into the valley, back to the people, back to the world, back to the world's problems, and waiting for him is a very specific problem. Waiting for him is a man who has a son who is possessed by a demon. And the problem is that not only is the man's son possessed by a demon, but the disciples have been unable to do anything about it. So not all of them were up on the mountain with Jesus. Some of them were back down doing work, it seems. And the work those disciples were trying to do was to cast out demons as Jesus had told them they would be able to do. Except they weren't here in this instance. And so Jesus casts the demon out of the man's son. But think of Jesus in that moment where he's watching these folks and he's seeing if they can do the things that he needs them to do. And he's telling them that you're going to have to be the ones to carry your cross. And he has this wonderful mountaintop moment. He comes down and he figures out they still don't look like they're ready. We're about to go to Jerusalem. This is about to get very serious and very different. And it feels like they're not ready. Two times in this chapter, Jesus speaks to them plainly about the fact that he will suffer and that he will die. And both times it seems to wash over them. It's not something they want to hear. And so they either don't hear it or they let it pass. But two times Jesus talks about this with them. All of that is the buildup to this moment. And to what might seem like a stupid question that's on the minds of the disciples. All those things I just told you about have happened. And then it says that Jesus hears them having an argument amongst themselves. Now the argument is not about what do you think Jesus is meaning when he's talking about how he's going to have to suffer and die, or how are we going to do better when we're supposed to be casting out demons, or how do you think we did out on that trip? The conversation they're having, the question that they're asking one another is, which of us is the greatest? That's what's on their mind. That's what they're talking to each other about. Which of us is the greatest? So to review, as they are being prepped for the work that they've been called to do, as Jesus is busy being identified as the Son of God, beloved by God on the mountain, as Jesus is telling them he must give his life for them, as all that's going on, the question on their mind is, which one of us is the greatest? To Jesus' credit, it seems like he's not upset about the question. And I think the reason he's not upset about the question, about the discussion that they're having, is because, again, it is an honest discussion. It's really the thing that they're concerned about right then. And so rather than pretending to be upset about something else or to be concerned about something they're not actually concerned about, they're actually talking about the thing that's at the front of their mind, which is, which of us is the greatest? Jesus wants to know their true hearts. And part of the reason you would want to know their true hearts in this situation is he needs to know what it is that they're actually interested in so that he can know what it is he needs to teach them. What is it you don't know that I need to show you so that you can understand what it is I want you to understand, regardless of the question you're asking? So he takes a child and he stands the child in front of them and he says, whoever welcomes this child in my name welcomes me. And whoever welcomes me welcomes the one who sent me. Whoever is least among you all is greatest. See what Jesus did there? Their question was, who is the greatest? Now Jesus isn't about to say, it's Peter. It's been Peter all along. The rest of you are all going for second place. That's not how Jesus is going to answer the question. What Jesus is going to say to them is the answer to not which one of them is the greatest, but if you want to be great, how do you get there? What is Jesus' expectation for you? If greatness is what you're after, then let's define greatness. And so Jesus stands that child there and says, whoever welcomes me welcomes the one who sent me. Whoever is least among you all is the greatest. Silence. There just had to be silence among them at that point. I suspect it stung a little bit. It's not really what we had in mind, Jesus. We were thinking, actually, when we think of great, not when you think of great. But thanks for the lesson. The disciples knew. They knew that Jesus knew about the conversation. There had to be a certain level of embarrassment that goes along with Jesus knowing that and having that object lesson for you. But they learned. They learned. We know they learned because we know what they became. So we know that everything that Jesus did, all those building blocks of everything he'd ever done, this being a very important one, slipped into place to build him into the disciples that built the church. We know what they become. They are going to have to get over their desire to be the greatest in the way that they had been thinking about it. Being the least, it turns out, is the pathway to greatness in God's kingdom. The interesting thing, and if we go back to the other scripture that we began with this morning, the interesting thing is that not everybody that was following Jesus was asking that question. It seems like there were some people who understood already what Jesus was talking about. And I would refer you back to, especially, to listen to listen on this Mother's Day Sunday to this passage about Jesus and some of his other followers. Soon afterward, Jesus traveled through the cities and villages, preaching and proclaiming the good news of God's kingdom. The 12 were with him, along with some women who had been healed of evil spirits and sicknesses. Among them were Mary Magdalene, from whom 7 demons had been thrown out, Joanna, the wife of Herod's servant Chuza, Susanna, and many others who provided for them out of their resources. Luke tells us of some of the women who make up the core of Jesus' ministry. Like, not peripheral to Jesus' ministry, the core of Jesus' ministry. And it begins by saying he had helped them. Jesus had helped these women. But then it goes on to say that these women that are named are the source of the resources for Jesus' work, for Jesus and for his followers. How they're able to live is through the generosity and the resources of these women who are named. And it's important that they're not only said the women, but that Luke actually gives us some names. Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, Susanna, Joanna. There are names given to us. We are not told about them fighting together at all. There's no mention of them having a discussion about which one of us is the best. It just says that they shared in Jesus' ministry. They shared their resources. Somewhere along the way, they learned the lesson that the pathway to greatness in the kingdom of God was going to be servanthood. And so that group was already on board modeling what servanthood looks like in the presence of all those who are following Jesus. Interesting thing, these women, who apparently are around throughout all of Jesus' ministry, will show up again by name one more time. Where might that be? Where will we see these women again? We will see them after the crucifixion, after the day of waiting, after the disciples have largely gone into hiding out of fear. We will see them as the first ones at that tomb, at the empty tomb. The servant leaders, the ones who have resourced Jesus, the ones who maybe perhaps in this way get it best. Do not fall away. Do not hesitate. But there they are back at the tomb. Among them, again, Luke names some folks. Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, and Joanna. And then he says, and the other women. A group of them supporting each other, going to the tomb, responding to the death of Christ. With what? A servant act in a hostile place. They're going to a tomb guarded by a Roman guard. They don't know what they're walking into. They certainly aren't expecting resurrection to have happened. But they're going into this place, a hostile environment, to do a servant thing, to, they think, care for the body of their Lord. It is interesting to note that Luke even mentions that, identifies one of them as the mother of James, Mary, the mother of James. So I think that's to differentiate her from Mary, but it's interesting to have her identified in that way as a mother. She is a mother. There is something maternal. There is something caring, and there is something loving, and there is something selfless in the action of these women. In the passage in chapter 8, as they provide for Jesus and for his followers, and later on at the tomb, that same quality is there. We will learn over time that the rest of the disciples got the message. They are all going to be pushed to that point where they will all, in their own way, become martyrs for the cause. and they will be willing to give everything for Jesus. But this moment goes a long way, I think, towards moving them in that direction. They do get it, but it takes time. Maybe that moment was the moment. That moment when they heard Jesus sort of reflect back to them. Remember when we were all talking about which of us was going to be the greatest? Oh, what an awful moment that was. But Jesus was pretty gentle with us. Jesus brought that child in and illustrated to us what he meant. It was an important step in a positive direction for them. I would invite you this day to give thanks for those in your life who have shown selfless love, who have been caring for no other reason other than that's who they were, who have in that way been compassionate to you, have been a servant to you because your needs were there and because they knew that they could minister to your needs. Let us give thanks for those folks. Let us aim, as the disciples learned to do in that moment, and as the women shows an example for us, let us aim to be the servant leaders that Christ calls us to be. And most importantly for this morning, let us embrace once again the idea there are no stupid questions. There are honest questions, and God indeed welcomes them. Thanks be to God. Amen.